resume our meeting because it's time to regulate some rates.
Thank you, Hans. Good morning, everybody. As Hans said, we're here to talk about rate-regulated activities, so agenda papers 6 through 6C. I appreciate 6C was an added paper, so if anybody hasn't got it in their packs, I do have a few hard copies here available if anybody would like a copy. But 6C just provides an alternative presentation to some of the numbers that are presented in paper 6B. So it's not new information, it's just different. In the papers that we have today, 6A is really a background paper summarising the discussions that have taken place to date, so we don't intend to discuss that specifically unless anybody has got any cracking points that they would like to pull out in that paper. The focus of today's discussion is really the measurement paper, paper 6B, supplemented by 6C. And in those papers, we've used 5 examples to try and demonstrate some issues related to how we might measure a regulatory asset that arises when, in the examples that we've got, the entity incurs costs in year one in delivering some services to customers. The rate regulator agrees that those costs are allowable, so the entity will be able to recover those costs through the bills that it sends to customers. But instead of being able to bill those customers at the full 100 in year one, the regulator is aware that he needs to fulfil his responsibilities to customers to provide greater stability and predictability of prices, so requires the entity to bill customers in 5 equal instalments of 20, and that fact pattern applies to examples 1 to 4. The difference between those 4 examples then relates to the time delay and the effect of the time delay. So in example 1, we've said that there's the time effects of money or the time value of money is not material. So in that example, we're using it to just illustrate what we've discussed in previous meetings about recognising an originating adjustment of 80, which is the difference between the allowable costs of 100 incurred and our right to eventually bill customers the 100 and the 20 that we've been allowed to bill just in the current year, year one. And then in the following 4 years, we have a reversal of 20 in each year as we bill customers our remaining right. In examples 2 to 4, we change that assumption and say the time value of money does have a material effect, and the difference in the fact patterns then becomes in example 2, the regulator assesses that 2% is the interest rate that's needed to compensate the entity for the effects of deferring the timing of recovery. Discounting back the cash flows using that 2% brings us back to the 80, so we're effectively in the same position as we were with example 1. And again, at the end of each year, the value of the asset discounting at 2% is 60, 40, etc. In example 3, the regulator, for whatever reason, decides not to give compensation for the time effects of money. And in that case, if we assume the 2% is the prevailing market rate to compensate for that time effect, if we discount back our regulatory assets at 2%, we come out at a lower number. And that means that we then need to decide whether we're going to recognise a day one loss, which is where we're interested in your comments. In example 4, we have a slightly different situation. In example 4, the regulator decides that as well as giving the entity compensation for the time value of money, the regulator decides to give the investors a return on their investment that's tied up for that time period, and therefore uses a weighted average cost of capital of 3.7%. But again, if we decide to discount back at the 2% prevailing market rate of interest, we come to a higher day one, a higher value for our regulated asset at the end of year one. So again, our question to you is, do we book a day one gain in that situation, or do we recognise that return on the investment over time? Example five has got a slightly different fact pattern, so I think it would be helpful maybe if we can discuss examples one to four first, and then we can come back and pick up comments on example five later. And with that, I'll open the floor to comments.
Thanks, Hans. Thanks, Jane. Before we get into the discussion, I guess a question that I wanted to ask is, this is looking at the measurement of the asset. Now, shouldn't we be looking at the nature of the asset first? And by that I mean, in these examples, we're looking at where, if I understand correctly, the costs of providing the services in year one were greater than what we either had initially expected that was built into the initial rate, or the demand was lower, effectively. But it relates to providing the services in year one, and those costs were higher than what we actually recovered. And I was wondering whether or not the nature of that type of regulatory asset is different to some of the other examples that we discussed at the previous meeting, where there might have been costs incurred in relation to maintenance and other things like that. And so I think here, if I'm right, we're only looking at where the actual costs of providing the services in year one were greater than what we actually recovered. And the reason why I think that distinction is important is because then for me it's, well, what is the nature of this asset? And I think that it looks it's more akin to a receivable for the services rendered in year one. And again, using the IFRS 15, by analogy, that your transaction price in year one, is variable, and it turned out to being, higher than what we initially had calculated, but we now know that it is higher. And the reason why I think that that's important is that I think then we should be analogizing to the treatment for a receivable, even if we're saying by definition it's not a receivable, which would then, for me, inform, the measurement. And then I would say, well, in short, you would need to take into account the time value of money. You would need to effectively be present valuing. And if, as in one of the examples, there was actually a return, so greater than just a recovery of those costs, well, then that is taken into account in year one, because that is all about, that is your transaction price for the services rendered in year one. In other words, it's not a return for services that will be rendered in the future. So it does relate to what has already been rendered. So the reason why I raised that was because there was an acknowledgement in the paper to say that, I think this is on paragraph 16 of paper 6B of our papers, that it seems to be similar to a contract asset in IFRS 15. And that's where I thought, well, I'm not sure, because if we are analogizing it to a contract asset in IFRS 15, are we referring there to fulfillment costs which have been capitalized, and therefore they've been capitalized in advance of us providing the services, and that's why we've got a contract asset under IFRS 15. And I would imagine there, and for me we should be then using the principles, if it were a contract asset under IFRS 15, well then we wouldn't be including a margin and all of that. We would only be recognizing that margin once the services are provided, which would only be in the future. But for me, if we're looking at costs we've already incurred in providing services that we've already provided, then I don't think the analogy to a contract asset under IFRS 15 seems appropriate. To me, the analogy should be drawn more to a receivable than the contract asset. And then for me, everything would flow in terms of accounting for a receivable. So the time value of money. So if it isn't there, you are going to have a loss up front. If there is a return, you're going to have, a profit, if you want to call it that. But it's because you have already rendered the services in year one. So that's where I would start in terms of saying we need to better define the nature of this asset before just looking and saying, does it make sense if we do this or we do that? I think we need to have a more robust starting point and then use existing principles to apply.
That's really helpful. Thank you.
It's just a quick question, because I think that's a very useful discussion, and I think it was something of what came up in the board meeting as well, in terms of just, does that logic work equally in the inverse situation where you've received the money first and have to deliver the service later?
Well, if you have received the money first and you're going to deliver the service later, then I would analogize again to IFRS 15 of where you've received payments in advance from your customer and you've got then a performance obligation, so which again could raise interesting questions around it, being a significant financing transaction, etc. But I would analogize to IFRS 15.
In that.
Thanks. So, building off of what Kim said, one of our observations on the discussion was that there are different types of circumstances that give rise to different types of either regulatory assets or liabilities. And so we're fully supportive of the notion of taking into consideration a present value concept, the time value of money. Even though we're classically in today's world more in a cost model, but we believe that recent standards should be taken into consideration. The concepts of recent standards should be taken into consideration. Certainly, I don't have a preconceived notion of where we're going to land, or that we're going to land where we are today in Canada versus someplace else. So I just want to make that clear, because some of my stakeholders may not agree with me, but that's where we are. The standards are. So we think it's important that you do take into consideration the different examples. And so when working through this, I think you have to think about it, the real-life examples where these regulatory assets and liabilities are created, and how does the logic apply? And is the cleaner analogy to, the contract asset versus the trade receivable or not? I personally have an issue in terms of, I'm stuck on the fact that when you're setting up an asset because the regulator has given you permission to do something and you haven't finished it yet, it seems like that asset is arising more as a relationship between the entity and the regulator as opposed to the entity and the customer. So I get a little hung up on that in terms of contract asset or not. Okay. So, but we think it's very important that we keep an open mind on this in terms of making sure that where we end up conceptually, whether it's a cost technique or a current value technique, that it does align with other deliberations that the board has recently made on new standards. So that, in rather than comment on, and we aren't troubled, by the way, about whether you'd recognize data gain or data loss. As long as it's clear that the users of the financial statements can see it and that they understand how it arose. The only issue there is, I'd urge you to consider the trade-off between complexity and applying the complexity and the necessary related disclosures versus, at the end of the day, what message are you trying to convey to people about the actual results in the performance statement and the results on the balance sheet.
Jim?
Similar to the comments just made, I think figuring out what the nature of the asset is important, and it's not as clear to me that, and I think Linda said this, in some cases it might look like cost of services already provided, deferred to future customers. In other cases, the cleanup of adverse storm damage may not be the cost of service already provided, it's cost of services deferred and passed on in the future, and those things may have different characteristics. In fact, in the latter example, it might, it wouldn't ordinarily be PPE cleanup costs, but putting the new poles or new things in might be. And some might question there, too, those poles have relatively little utility but for providing that future service. And why would you account for those at a cost model? Because the regulator may well limit your ability to pass on those costs, may include a profit, or some of the very same questions that you would have with respect to the cleanup cost itself. And so there, I don't think we're, you know, at least in the U.S., and I don't think here you're talking about changing that from just a strict cost model, even though it has the same issues. You may only be able to pass on the cost. You may be able to pass on the cost plus a profit. You may be able to pass on the cost plus a cost of interest plus an excess profit. And we're not talking about day one gains on putting in fixed assets, but those same issues arise. And so figuring out what is the nature of the asset and then what is the measurement model versus the measurement mechanics that you're looking at.
Patricia.
We've been working through all of these examples and really started to try to deduce what are the principles that are implicit in the examples that are being provided. So if we start with the scope requiring a regulatory adjustment mechanism, because that seems to be one of the key parts of the potential scope, then should we here be saying, if the past event is that the regulator has said there will be an adjustment, and the regulator has said when, is that the key to what we're doing, rather than saying, what is the cause of the adjustment, why should we have it? But simply to say, we know there's an adjustment, we know there's an adjustment in year 3 and 5 and 8, they come from a variety of causes, and the measurement issue is discount, yes, no, if so, what rate, remeasure the following year if you want a current rate, or is it a locked-in rate? It's those issues that we need to be thinking about, and the question we're saying is, does the nature of the asset matter, or is it only the fact that it is an adjustment driven by the mechanism? So really, can we get to the principles, start debating those, because the examples we get, you know, we're looking at each example in isolation, and I think it's getting to the stage where it's not very useful, because you look at example one and say, yeah, why not? And you look at example two and say, it sort of looks okay, but they're not hanging together.
I mean, we have been quite supportive of thinking about the IFRS 15 idea by analogy, and of course we still support that idea. Personally, I'm not very convinced that classification as a receivable is the core issue here, because if we have a receivable, I mean, we need a contract, we are more in the IFRS 9 territory. And I would have thought that this top line of this trend revenue in most of the examples is exactly this idea. We are going back to the standard IFRS 15 model as soon as we have a particular customer with a particular contract. So the issue is more, okay, what do we do before that? No customer or customer base and no contract. And I personally am more in the camp of treating this by analogy as a contract asset. I think the core question is, could somebody have come up with the idea saying that's a deferral, more a deferred income or deferred expense idea? And my thinking behind that is then probably you could conclude we shall not discount this. And I thought that was, for example, 1, 2, and 3, one of my key questions is the discounting idea, the good idea saying we have a fair value of a consideration received in the future, i.e. present value model, so we have a discounting exercise here. And probably that's the first step to see. And that's, I think, the key question, what's the nature of this assets question mark? Is the discounting the right starting point? And example 4, and don't want to move forward too much, I think that's another question coming in, that's this profit allocation exercise, because example 4, I think, is a little bit different to the other three, because it's not only about time value of money. There is a difference between this risk or this inflation rate type of thing and the discount rate, at least in one of your scenarios. So there's an additional element coming into the time value of money concept. That's a true margin, I would say, an operational margin. So that could be, I personally wouldn't agree with both of the outcomes here, but probably might come back to that in a second. So that's what I say. So probably I agree that the nature question is important, but what I would, the simple question for me is the discounting correct, yes or no? And I assume the answer is not that easy.
Thank you, Hans. Well, First of all, I like the example and focusing on the way we present it in the PNL, because my view, we discuss a lot about the asset and what kind of asset it is and how to measure it. But in the view we have in France, I think we are more focused on the PNL adjustment. And therefore, I would also suggest that we don't exclude other kinds of standards, like IS-12 or IS-20, which may closely interact. I think IS-12 in some instance is comparable because it's based on regulatory, it's supplemental also, and it doesn't consider any discounting of the cash flows. So it may not be a must, the discounting. I would pick up on what Linda said previously on the complexity that we may have in differentiating in the P&L between the financial effect and the other kind of adjustment. I think we see already in a very simple example how complicated it is already. It is. After a while, when the different adjustment will pile up in the P&L, there is probably a question of relevance for the user to clearly understand what is the effect or what is the component of the adjustment. What may matter is that the regulatory system is organized in order to provide a certain margin. Maybe we can focus more on what is expected from that information, because in my understanding the standard aim to provide additional information to what we already have under the other standards.
Thank you.
Kimberly.
I guess similar to a lot of the other comments, trying to think about the questions that you've posed, it was a struggle to kind of answer them without more clarity around the nature of the asset. And I think that sort of comes through today, and also the world standard setters, even sort of following the logic through and how you've described what the asset is a right to increase the price. Because first of all, I started thinking about, should I worry about what kind of past event it was? So similar to others, did I think about, well, this is an input cost, or at the World Standard Centre, you had that PP&E example. So did I think about, well, there's different kinds of reasons that give you this debit balance. So if it's a cost recovery, for example, normally when you spend money on something and it creates an asset, the nature of that asset depends on what you spend the money on. So if it's PP&E or it's inventory or whatever it is, and that then drives how you think about measuring it. And then I thought, well, does that actually help in this scenario? Because there's all sorts of reasons that will give rise to debit balances. And would that be incredibly complicated if we had different measurement requirements depending on what gives rise to the debit balance? And also, is that consistent with how you're describing? Because you've said you focus on the past event as a reason for why there's an asset that exists, and the way you're describing the asset is it's a right to increase prices in the future on favourable terms. That is the asset. So it sounds like there is actually only one kind of asset. There's not multiple kinds of assets depending on what the past event was. So that suggested to me I should be focusing on that single kind of asset. So in thinking that through, in terms of your questions, first of all, on the one about the loss, in fact, I thought, well, the answer to that should be irrespective of what kind of asset you think it is. I think there should be a loss, because whether it's like a financial asset or a non-financial asset or whatever it is, we have a general principle not to state assets at above their recoverable amount. And while we don't discount in the context of IS-12, my understanding, and Peter can correct me if I'm wrong here, my understanding is the lack of discounting there is because of the difficulty of doing the discounting. It's a practical reason, not that conceptually you shouldn't do it. And I felt that practical reason, while this is potentially a complicated model, that the reasons for recognising the asset and how you've described it, and what you're going to need to do for regulatory purposes to actually track when these things occur and reverse, I felt that you ought to be able to do the DCF calculation, and therefore I think that, yes, you should be recognising a loss, and I would struggle to see why you would not have a loss if it's not recoverable, if you're not being compensated for the time value of money. When I then turn to the next question about, well, what would I do if there was a, if I did a DCF and I got a gain, should I have a day one gain? And I think similar to Kim's comments, I was thinking about, well, what kind of asset is this? If it's a right to increase prices and therefore get some extra money in the future, some future cash flows, and that relates to something I've already done in the past, so there's a past event occurred that created this asset, that sounds like I've actually already done the thing that entitles me to this future cash flows. And you've also talked about that although the collection of those cash flows is through future billings to customers, that's the mechanism getting the future cash flows, as opposed to, so I shouldn't be thinking about this, I'm delivering goods and services in the future and they're paying me. You've said, well, yes, that particular piece of it actually relates to something I've done in the past, as opposed to my future delivery of goods or services. So that also led me down a path of saying, actually, it's more like I should be using some sort of current measure for this. It's more like, even though it's not a financial asset and that there is no contractual right to collect the future cash flows to customers, it's more akin to something that's similar to that, and therefore should actually have the gain. I did think about where people will disagree with that because there's often sort of future performance element to it, but again, I kept coming back to, well, if I think about, is there a future performance element, is that somehow inconsistent? I didn't really, I guess, get to a definitive answer on that, and I think more clarity around the nature of the asset will help, but thinking about it as a single asset did tend to me to go down that path. I then sort of got down to the point where I thought, well, some people aren't going to like that answer, and sort of getting back to some of the comments that have been around, it's all about performance statement that's driven this project. It's my understanding that end users haven't been saying we're worried about missing assets and liabilities. They've talked more about the impact on the performance statement. And so I guess it's similar to the debates around, is this an asset and liability in the first place? If you really are trying to get to some answer in the performance statement, then maybe you can justify some sort of cost approach. But in saying that, I think the bottom line is don't see how you could state that at above its recoverable amount. So whatever you do, I think one is that it has to be a loss. My preference on two is to think about it as a series of cash flows, so some sort of DCF model. But I guess, again, you've got to come back to the objectives you're trying to achieve. Yes.
Thank you. The first question is about the nature of the assets that is similar to others. The second question is about the measurement. Although in this paper, the example describes a scenario that the real cash flow could match the entity's expectation, but in reality, we think there are maybe a lot of two judgment or estimate. Under this model, there are a lot of uncertainty for the measurement. For example, you need to make estimates on the future cash flow. You need to what kind of discount rate you should use. And how long will it take effect? In this example, it's 5 years. And so based on this, so we think maybe this model, the measurement is subjective under this model, which may also lead to some problems on earnings measurement. So that's our big concern. That's, can we get reliable measurement under this model?
Yeah, thank you.
So we suggest maybe further research is needed, and we should take careful action. Thank you.
Sven?
Yeah, so while I've heard from the discussion, I think we can more or less make a take on this idea of present value, and I think also on this loss-making case on day one. I think what's interesting is example four. So we are in the situation of a gain, and I think you have basically put forward two different options how the discounting exercise could work in this case. And I would rule out the second option. I would say the discounting should always work with what you call this prevailing market rate, because that's the economically more accurate way, I would say. Which leaves us with option one, and then of course mathematically we have this day one gain because of the difference between what the rate regulator gives us and what we are discounting. However, I wouldn't agree that we should show this gain on day one, like it is done in the example. And probably that's going back, and thank you very much for your explanation, Kimberly. I think where the thinking comes from is if you say this is also a receivable on day one, so there is a contractual right to get the cash, then I would agree and say, okay, then it's a gain. If there is a contractual right, that's a gain. Probably in some cases, and some people might have a different view and say, no, it's more this contract asset type of thing. It's not clear on day one, there's no contractual right to get the cash. So it's a contract as an IFRS 15 analogy type of thing. And then I would say this 3.2 gain we see here in the example on day one, I would see on a what we may call a systematic basis over the 5 years. Straight line could be proportionate over the revenue, but that's something like that. So that's what I would expect. And if we think how IFRS 15 work by analogy and think about this as a finance component, that's probably what would come out there as well, saying there is probably a finance component which is then unwinded as discount over time. But anyway, there might be a margin which would also be POC type stretched over the 5 years, and we would not see necessarily the gain on day one if we conclude there is a performance obligation over time. So that's my analogous thinking. So having said that, I wouldn't agree with both of the outcomes you propose in example four. I would propose a third one, which is this more straight line method.
Mary?
I'd like to come in with just an observation about IFRS 15 and the analogies to the different part. And Jim Croker, heads up. I want to put you on notice to correct me if I make any errors in the talking about the converged standard, because I think we're the same on this one, which is that IFRS 15's distinction between a contract asset and a receivable depends really, to me, only on whether you have an unconditional right to receive the cash. Let's say because there is no milestone you have to hit before you can bill, versus a conditional that you don't have the right to bill yet, although the contract asset represents your entitlement to revenue for activities conducted to date. And so a contract asset is with profit rather than just a cost-based measurement. So that's just a comment about the distinction. So if, say, you were in a long-term contract that said you can only bill when you hit these milestones, and you're between milestones at a reporting date, the point is that you have a contract asset, but that would include the profit earned for activities to date, rather than it being cost only until you get to the milestone. So I wanted to make that difference, because people seem to be referring to the analogy to contract asset as if that would determine whether it was a with or without profit measurement. And to me, and Jim, I'm looking at you for confirmation, but I did go to the secret storage cupboard to pull out the books to just check the discussion in paragraph 107 of IFRS 15 on that.
Yeah, I don't think there's any difference.
Okay.
I think the difference in this case would be a receivable would probably tell me, okay, it's a gain on day one, whereas a contract asset, you could go to this thinking, is there a performance obligation over time, and then allocate the margin or an increasing margin over time?
If you have a contract, if you're recognizing at a reporting date a contract asset because, let's say, you've not hit the next milestone, that contract asset includes the profit for activities conducted to date.
Yeah.
So there is no deferral of the recognition of profit for future performance. And so if you say it's a contract asset, you know, if you're saying my analogy is to a contract asset, the question then is, have I performed the activities that earn me that right? And if you say I have performed, then I think you'd say that you'd measure it with profit. So I think if you're looking to IFRS 15 and, you know, the contract asset analogy, it would either be, you know, zero or with, you know, with profit. It wouldn't be cost but no profit.
Yeah. And I think, you know, just to add there, I think the key thing is the clarification on the performance obligation. Has that already been satisfied, so the services have already been provided in year one? Or is it a case of, no, they're only going to be provided in years two, three, four, and five? Because that is going to then affect this. So absolutely agree. If the services have already been rendered, then I like that answer.
And I think, sorry, in 15, a contract asset, you mentioned, Kim, earlier, you can. There are different types of contract assets because there's the cost to fulfil a contract type of contract asset, yes, which in that case you haven't yet performed.
That's
so
right.
I think to talk about contract assets as a single type of asset gives us the confusion we've got here.
Correct.
As well, in that it depends on the nature of the asset. You're,
yes,
absolutely right.
Yeah.
Sorry, Mary.
Yeah.
Jim? So going to the point of, you know, thinking about discounting and a loss different from the gain, and I don't, at least in the U.S., I think we hear users look at the asset base,
right,
and as sort of a total, and they then expect a return on that asset base. And so if there's a portion, and I don't think in that sense they differentiate PP&E or other things in the asset base in which they can charge a return on. So if a portion of that asset base going to the pulling forward of what some might think is future profit, other could argue is profit for fulfillment already, if you start splitting that into, this is the portion of my asset base for which I've already recognized the return, this is the portion of my asset base for which I have not recognized the return, is that going to be useful to users or not? And I don't know, at least in the U.S., we hear that users look at the total asset base and they know the rate of return to expect. So I suspect if we started booking return on a portion and not booking it on another portion, there's going to at least need to be some explanation as to how to model that asset base.
Thank you. Actually, we are supportive of the proposals in the papers. I think the notion of the proposed model is based on, actually, as you know, regulatory agreement. It's not on customer contracts. So actually, in this context, which the most important is that the revenue of the rate regulated entity will be determined. What is the basis of the recognition of revenue under the defined rate regulation? Actually, the revenue should be based on regulatory agreement. So the entity should recognize as an asset, regardless of the contract, according to the regulatory agreement, because the compensation of the service provision will be determined by the regulatory agreement ultimately. So the rate adjustment should be recognized as an asset in the year when the entity provided the service. So vice versa. I think it's our understanding that the liability side, regulatory liability, could be easily drawn, rational will be drawn. So in that rationale, we think the suggested examples conclusions are supportive. So we think the separation of financing factor, that is time value of money from the amount of the compensation for service provision, could represent more faithfully and with more usefulness about operating performance conducted. And the financing outcomes, so the two factors should be separated in, on the face of it. Finance, income statement, and the current market interest rate is, we think, a relatively objective indicator of the time value of money as a discount rate. Using the current market interest rate would let the entities separate the future return financing factors from the compensation amount, and the entities can report the variance from the interest, market interest, as on as a finance factors. So I mean, the entity should separate the performance of service and the financing factors. So that concept could give us the principle in all the cases. Yeah. Thank you.
Thank you. Okay, many things have been said. I think that mostly this classification issue depends on the scope of this project, whether we include some specific rate regulations. I understand that the example is based on a case in which there is an enforceable right for the entity to charge customers in future periods. So I wouldn't see why we shouldn't borrow as much as possible guidance in IFRS 15 for measuring the assets and potentially not forgetting that there could be a liability in the future and not an asset. And IFRS 15 is symmetric and helps to treat equally both assets and liabilities. So we shouldn't forget that there might be a cost constraint, because usually utilities have a number of tariffs, a number of different regions in which they operate. So there could be a big overlapping between rights and obligations from different zones and tariffs. And so it could be a nightmare to account with this finance component. So we might consider to update the interest discount rate to help not to create too many layers, difficult to track. Having said that, I think that going through the examples, example one, I would consider this also this cost constraint point on measuring, and the fact that our thought process is right is confirmed by example three, because in example three, if you do not discount, you recognize a day one that is not really a day one.
Cédric.
Thank you. Just one word about the question of performance rights and obligation. Maybe we could also consider that it is a pure regulatory adjustment. That means that maybe at the market level, there is an equation saying that the rights and the obligation are the same. At entity level, that situation may not be a direct link, and therefore it may be a question of measurement, how the adjustment is calculated for that entity, but it's completely independent of any performance of the PM. It's just because the entity was dealing on the market at that moment that they got the right to have another rate in the future. That was the first thinking about the customer base principle. That's just what I wanted to add, that the direct link which is made in some discussion about what the entity has actually performed or will perform in the future may not be completely relevant, or we could see another model where it would be only by being present at the moment instead of performing anyway.
Thank you. Jim, may I ask on your US GAAP's experience? So could you explain more clarification on the issue of the cost of equity? In your case, even that cost of equity can be capitalized in the amount of a PP&E, right? When you construct an item of PP&E, that generally we just add maybe borrowing cost, standard just allow you to capitalize
interest
expense on.
Yes.
But in the case of your regulatory and accounting standard, you are going one step further. You are allowing to capitalize the cost of equity too, in addition to that interest expense, to the amount of PP&E. So what I'm saying is it's quite an issue because we are going to deal with another example. That example will think about that construction of a PP&E, not the this one here. So, but the same issue, whether you can recognize some kind of cost of equity or return.
Right.
So the same issue. So could you explain your experience on that specific requirement and some kind of practical things that you have?
So it's an area that I can look into and get back to you, but I don't have experience with the cost of equity component other than, I think U.S. GAAP provides for, to the extent that you can pass on costs, a capitalization model, but it doesn't pull, today it's a cost model. It doesn't think about, it's have I incurred a cost and can I pass it on? It isn't a contract asset type model that says I've already performed and therefore I could book a profit on that component. And I think, as we've talked about this, there seems to be aspects of both. There are things where it looks like you've already performed to a past customer and you're going to bill it to the future. There are costs for which it doesn't look like you've performed yet. It's cleanup of storm damage or all kinds of other startup type costs, which at least in the U.S. we have no model today that allows you to book profit on startup type costs, even though you might be able to pass those costs on to a customer in the future. And I think even RevRec has that. If there's certain costs that are internally incurred prior to the contract but are directly related to, and in that context we don't book a profit, but if it's a contract asset where fulfillment has occurred, and that's why I think figuring out what is the nature of this thing, and frankly it probably has the nature of both, and do you want to complicate it into two models or three models, or do you want to say it looks more like this or more like that?
I think if I can just confirm, the PP&E issue is an additional complexity to the examples that we do intend to come back and discuss that, and that there may be, and again, I'm not quite so familiar with US GAAP, so we'll need to do a little bit more research, but I think there might be differences between IFRS and US GAAP outside of rate regulation that may be driving some of the differences in the perceptions about the model going forward.
And I think PP&E in this space starts to look an awful lot like some of these other costs, because once you put the thing there, its value is highly dependent upon your ability to pass that cost on to the customer. There's not some alternative use once you've sunk poles in the ground. And so why would I look at those things differently than other costs regulators let me pass on?
Yeah, exactly. So we'll come back to it, but I think it's probably outside of the scope of this discussion today.
One clarification, you know, as Kim said, many people said, you know, this is an issue about what performance is. So they are based on the US GAAP, that example, if we see, you are assuming a kind of a, all kind of activity, not just providing goods and service to the customer basis. If you're building a kind of one item of PPE, US GAAP is assuming this is a just one distinct performance, so we can recognize any profit. Is that right? My understanding is wrong.
I think it's too complicated, Chung Wu, to get into that level of detail at this particular thing, because it is very specific. And again, in US GAAP, there's different out.
Gets more complicated.
Yeah. You're really the
complicated. Just a couple of observations, in part thinking all the way back to Patricia's comment about models, etc. But when we focus in on the examples, I think we have to remember that what we are exploring right now, and I'm going to reference a diagram that gets put up quite often with two different loops, so that when we are talking about past performance, it really is in the context of the entity's relationship with the regulator, rather than past customers, future customers, et cetera, because I think the way, and I think clearly what we have said so far about this model that we're exploring is the entity's relationship with its retail customers for the delivery of whatever the item is something that's outside the scope. So some of the complexity of have I delivered to past customers, will I recover from future, it's not complicating the application of IFRS 15, because right. 15 is looking solely at your relationship with individual customers. What we're looking at when we're saying there's this left-hand side of the entity's relationship with its rate regulator, accounting for that, first of all, we're doing standard setting, not interpretation, so we don't have to look at existing models and say what applies by analogy, although I think it is very helpful to think about what another, you know, standard would say if we were applying it to the situation. Clearly, we're not in the case of an entity's relationship with its regulator, because it's not a customer performance obligation in the sense of 15. That's one thing. And the second is, so, you know, Patricia, the reason I cited your point is I think you have to remember that when we start talking about what would 15, for example, tell me to do in this case, because it's not a direct application of 15. It's thinking about what the principles might drive me towards. I think while there is complexity in terms of thinking about the different nature of things, it's something we actually have to do under 15. Because as Jim was just saying, the contract asset notion comes into play only when the entity has performed and it's saying, what have I earned in respect of what I have performed today? The entity also then considers, what costs have I incurred? And if I have incurred costs for obligations I have not satisfied, performance obligations I have not satisfied, what do existing standards tell me about how to account for those costs? And it's only in very limited circumstances that 15 says, here's some guidance on those costs, and those costs are when I have not transferred any control to the customer. Now, in this case, we're never really transferring control of things to the regulator, but we have to remember that we're kind of looking at the regulator as a pseudo customer when we're thinking about it. So it's kind of back to that's when you get more into the cost accounting model. So I guess I'm saying that 15 has that complexity of saying I have to look at my activities and determine whether the costs are related to an obligation that I've satisfied or an obligation I haven't satisfied, and decide whether I'm accounting on a cost basis or a fair value of consideration entitlement, depending upon whether I've satisfied the obligation or not. And that's just a comment about how at a gross level, the thinking in 15 would apply if we were trying to apply those principles. It's not saying that we have to, or that I think 15 is the only relevant standard, kind of to Cedric's point about are we focusing too narrowly on 15?
Okay, finally, Sven, and then we...
I'll just echo what Mary just said. I think what I've learned from this discussion, what's quite important, I think, is getting a good understanding of what exactly is the fact pattern in this regulatory environment and to see, okay, what is this regulated performance, I would call it, and this, let's say, your relationship with the regulator. And obviously, there are different models around the world, and probably sometimes it's really related to past services, probably sometimes it's also related to future services. Probably with regard to your examples, a good test to deal with this could be, well, let's assume these expenses of 100 operating are not in year one, they are in year two, three, four, or five, and you can basically pick and choose in which year you perform this sort of maintenance service. I mean, we had similar examples at World Center Service, for example. And the question is, would you then also allocate the 3.2 profit in our example here to this one year when you do this maintenance, or is there some sort of feeling, no, it should be more a smoothening, matching principle type of thing over these. And probably that's a good
test. What matching principle?
Okay. We had exactly this question 2 days ago.
There's no matching concept.
Yeah, but probably that's a good test, a little bit playing around with these, when do we perform this maintenance or these expenses, and is this impacting the profit allocation?
When we look at the relationship between the relationship between the regulator and the entity, I think we should not lose from sight that the regulator is acting on behalf of the customers, and there is no, I mean, in my view, no real economic relationship between the regulator and the entity, because there is no exchange between them two. So to me, the accounting model that we're working on is a supplement to IFRS 15, because IFRS 15 fails to take into account this extra relationship where the regulator acts on behalf of the customer. And to me, as a result, I would expect that this accounting model does not lead us to requiring recognition of profit when there has not been any control over anything transferred to anybody.
All right.
Sorry, just to very quickly finish off, I know we haven't done example five, but I think the comments that have come around the room have really sort of encapsulated some of the issues that I was looking at dealing with in example five. So I've got a lot of information to take away. I'm not going to try and respond. I've had lots of questions today, lots of issues to think about. I'm not going to respond straight away, but hopefully it means that I'll be able to come back in a future meeting with a much clearer picture of what I think the drivers are for the model, and be able to explain those more clearly. And just to thank everybody, not just for this meeting, but also the World Standard Setters, where we discussed related issues about recognition and timing. It's been a hugely productive combination of meetings, so thank you very much indeed.